Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All those great financial minds with vast experience on Wall Street insist they never saw it coming. In fact, we heard today that some weren't even aware just how deep they were in high-risk investments. But one executive explained it was all in good faith. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering GoToMyPC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad you're joining us. It was Take the Bankers to the Woodshed Day again in Washington. On the hot seat this time, Citigroup executives. Former CEO Charles Prince said he was sorry for errors that forced taxpayers to offer up a $45 billion bailout for Citigroup. Former Citigroup senior advisor Robert Rubin didn't go quite that far.
We all bear responsibility for not recognizing this, and I deeply regret that.
At the same time, Rubin insisted that no one brought potential problems on Citi's balance sheet to his attention. So more than a year and a half after the financial crisis, where exactly does the buck stop? Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in New York.
Citigroup lost tens of billions of dollars because of its exposure to complex investments in the mortgage market. The idea that a senior advisor was unaware of the risk involved doesn't make sense to Simon Johnson. He's a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management and co-author of the new book, 13 Bankers.
I mean, it's not their job to sit back and enjoy $100 million or whatever it is Mr. Rubin made. Their job is to ask questions. Their job is to understand what's going on. Their job is to interact with people on the outside and to really be tough on management. But clearly, that's not what they were doing.
Johnson calls the failures of executives at all the major banks incompetence at best. But he says,
I don't think anybody is capable of controlling these mammoth financial institutions.
Former investment banker Douglas Elliott, now at the Brookings Institution, says the problem was a mindset, not the actions of any one person.
We all got too relaxed, and we started making assumptions like house prices would never go down systematically across the entire country. When you're working with a viewpoint like that that turns out to be wrong, there are going to be major problems.
He says, of course, CEOs, risk managers, and board members are ultimately responsible for their institutions, but looking for a single scapegoat is futile.
I'm not saying no one has responsibility, but it's significant that so many tens of thousands, if not in some senses millions of people, made the same mistake. That says we have to focus on what was driving the mistake, not what did a particular person do.
Elliott says a Wall Street witch hunt, while perhaps emotionally satisfying, won't help us avoid another crisis. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Whenever Apple CEO Steve Jobs holds a press event, it's always, well, an event. Today he unveiled, wait for it, a new iPhone operating system. It can run dozens of applications at the same time. Jobs also announced that consumers have snapped up 450,000 iPads since Saturday. What he didn't mention is how Apple has been in a frenzy to fix the iPad's Wi-Fi problems, as in users are complaining they can't connect or stay connected to the Internet. Now, this is Apple's biggest release in years, and you might have thought the company would catch this kind of glitch before it went on sale. So we asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to find out how this could happen.
Call it the curse of the early adopter. Every time a hot new gadget hits the market, it seems there's a big problem the manufacturer missed.
I, for example, had a problem with the iPad this morning.
That's Yankee Group analyst and proud new iPad owner Carl Howe. He's had some problems with his iPad's Wi-Fi connection dropping out. He says this is inevitable for an innovative product like the iPad.
Anytime you're doing something really new, not in just one dimension, but in several dimensions, where you've got new hardware, new software, new user interaction, then you're going to have more problems.
So why don't companies catch big glitches like these? Renee Ritchie is with TipBee.com. He says it all comes down to cost-benefit.
they decide how much money they can spend on testing versus how much money it will cost them to fix problems later. And wherever they start to cross that line, that's where they stop.
But Ritchie says Apple has more of these problems than most companies. He says that's partly because Apple is so secretive. Companies like Microsoft put a product out months before a launch so select users can try it out and report problems, but not Apple.
Apple's got a completely different culture, and they market based on that kind of a culture. They don't do beta testing. They don't let the public even see it before Steve Jobs, you know, puts Sneaker to stage. I think that kind of compounds the problems for them when it does hit the market.
It also compounds the hype. Yankee Group's Carl Howe estimates Apple will sell more than 3 million iPads this year, and it's already got a fix in the works for those Wi-Fi glitches. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
President Obama wants a report from mine safety officials next week on steps to prevent a repeat of the deadly explosion that left at least 25 miners dead in West Virginia. Rescuers at the Upper Big Branch mine ran into dangerous gas today. They had to suspend efforts to reach four others who might have survived. It's hoped they made it into a sealed chamber. Meantime, Congress is planning hearings. Specifically, lawmakers want to know whether mine operators are purposely dragging out disputes over safety citations. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Congress tightened safety regulations at mines and increased penalties in 2006. Before the tougher penalties, mine operators contested one in three fines. Now they appeal two-thirds.
This is a strategy that some in the coal industry are using to delay enforcement.
Celeste Monforton teaches public health and worker safety at George Washington University. She says mine owners are clogging the appeal system to put off harsher fines. Mine operators say the problem is that mines with lots of safety citations can be labeled repeat offenders. That leads to higher fines or even closure.
It's kind of one of these financial incentives that's working in a little bit of a perverse way.
Carol Ralston is a National Mining Association spokeswoman. She says mine owners are appealing a lot because they want to avoid that repeat offender label.
You have a little bit of a financial responsibility to challenge that, because the next time you do have an infraction, then there's this multiplier effect.
Ralston says if there is a safety violation, mines have to fix it while they contest the fine. But United Mine Workers spokesman Phil Smith says usually mines keep operating with just quick fixes.
We're not talking about, you know, issues with, you know, your tools are in the wrong place. You know, we're talking about stuff like methane buildup, improper ventilation controls.
When methane gas builds up in a mine, it can cause massive explosions, like the one Monday at the Upper Big Branch mine. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street rallied today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll admit it. The computer news we're about to bring you is kind of nerdy, but it could also be hugely important. Scientists at Hewlett-Packard announced they've come up with a new technology for computer chips, and they say it'll revolutionize how our electronics will work in the future. They're called memristors, and they could change the way we use computer chips. Think fast, and think small, as in microscopic. To help us break this down, we have the Wall Street Journal's Deputy San Francisco Bureau Chief and technology writer Don Clark. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So I know this about computer chips. They're magical and they make my computer run, but remind us what they do to make that happen.
Computer chips are a shrinking of all those old components they used to have in the old days, like tubes and transistors. And basically they do all the things you want in your electric device to do, to store information, to do calculations, to add numbers together, and run software and all those kind of great things. And so what the electronics industry tries to do is to make those things better and better and faster and cheaper each year.
And I'm assuming that HP's new technology is going to do something different. What is that?
Basically, as companies try to shrink the circuitry inside computer chips, there were fears that they would stop being able to do so at a certain point, and those devices we all love would stop getting better. So this memristor, this device that combines memory and resistance, is a kind of a new way to keep that progress going, to keep shrinking that circuitry and making it faster and cheaper and use less energy.
Now, I understand that fundamentally there's a physical limit to just how small you can get. How small are we getting here?
The little elements in chips today are around 30 to 50 nanometers. That's billionths of a meter. Now, they fabricated these little memristors as small as just three of those. And so it's about a tenth the size of anything that people are using today, and it could get even smaller.
Now, what does that mean for storage? I remember when I was impressed I could put a dozen songs on a thumbnail-sized chip. Now I can fit almost my whole music collection on a chip half that size. What's next?
Well, exactly. It's going to get better and better, but what the problem was, people were thinking that you just could stop shrinking at a certain point, so this will keep the shrinking going for quite a while longer. And the other thing that HP found is that these things not only can store information, but they can also do calculation. And so it helps ensure that those technologies keep getting faster and smaller, too.
So what does this mean for the companies that produce this technology?
Well, it means that they don't have to worry about having to get into some other business, that eventually there should be a way to keep the pace of innovation going.
What changes do you think we're likely to see in our electronic gadgets as a result of this technology?
There are several ways this could go. This could help make a device like the iPad, say, a lot less expensive. That's one direction it could go. It could make something like that a lot smaller. It could make something like that use a lot less electricity, or it could make it much, much more powerful. And it kind of depends on what the designer wants to do to get the desired effect.
You mentioned power. I'm wondering, does that mean that if you're dealing with atomic-sized particles, it takes a lot less power to move them around? Are we going to see a lot longer battery life? You could have a cell phone, say, that only needed charging, say, once a month.
Yes. I think that's one of the implications of this technology. You could decide to have about the same performance as today and just keep reducing the power consumption so that they can last hours and hours and weeks and months.
Don Clark is Deputy San Francisco Bureau Chief and a technology writer for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Kindly put down your cell phone now and please pay attention. More states are establishing bans against talking and texting while driving. But the question of how to enforce those laws and catch drivers in the act is a tough one. Today, the Obama administration announced a new project to help police officers in two states crack down on distracted driving. WNYC's Colin Campbell has this report.
At any given moment in America, 812,000 vehicles are driven by someone using a handheld cell phone. They cause one out of every six fatal crashes. So transportation officials and cops around the country are trying to stop these distracted drivers. Chuck DeWeese works for the governor of New York's Traffic Safety Committee.
Meet a family who had a loved one killed because somebody was texting LOL to somebody else. It makes you want to throw up.
The Department of Transportation program hopes to follow the success of Click It or Ticket seatbelt enforcement. The agency is splitting $400,000 between two states, Connecticut and New York. That's where Shannon Trice of the Syracuse Police Department comes in. He's helping to develop that city's program.
We are going to look for people's behaviors. We're going to be looking for cell phones up to the ear, cell phones in the hand. We're going to be looking for people looking down their lap and using their hands texting. And we're going to try and catch people through observation.
Trice also plans to use plainclothes officers and surprise checkpoints. In crash investigations, he'll subpoena phone records to see if the driver was texting or talking. On a recent afternoon, Captain Trice parked his unmarked car on a corner in Syracuse. 4 minutes later, a silver Nissan went by, its driver breaking the law.
She's talking on her cell phone.
So she was talking to it in front of her face.
Yes.
But here's where things get interesting. Just as Captain Trice starts to pull over the driver, his own cell phone starts.
This is a quintessential phone call, pulling over somebody and getting interviewed. Distractions.
It's the third call he's received in the last half hour on patrol. This time, he doesn't answer and pulls over the driver in the Nissan.
Good afternoon, ma'am. Shannon Trice with Syracuse Police Department. The reason I stopped is because I saw you talking on your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an explanation for that?
No, I don't.
Okay. Do you have a license and registration?
Yeah.
Trice says it took 5 years of heavy seatbelt enforcement before he saw that behavior change. This new federal and state money will pay cops overtime to ticket as many distracted drivers as they can. It all begins today in hopes of getting the word out by the busy summer driving season. In Syracuse, New York, I'm Colin Campbell for Marketplace.
Coming up, British vets struggle to land jobs.
I'm rapidly approaching 40. The civilian job market can be quite ruthless. If I don't start working soon, people might start thinking he's a bit too old.
But first, let's do the numbers. Strong retail sales figures for March helped lift the markets today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 29 points, about 0.25%, to finish at 10,927. The Nasdaq gained 5 points, also about 0.25%, to close at 2,436. And the S&P 500 added 3 points, or 0.33%, to wrap up at 1,186. The FDA announced the safety review of a chemical found in antibacterial soap and other consumer products. Colgate-Palmolive saw its stock price drain about 0.67%. Procter & Gamble lathered up about 0.1%. Amazon led gainers in the retail sector, rising more than 4.5%. Chain stores got a bump, too. Both Target and The Gap rang up more than 3%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at ProduceMoreConserveMore.com. And by MassMutual, offering a financial literacy program to help families navigate their finances. Details at MassMutual.com/familyfinances. An eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its monthly wholesale trade report for February. In Prague, President Obama meets with the President and Prime Minister of the Czech Republic before flying back to Washington. And he sold a lot of magazines. Hugh Hefner turns 84. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. The Social Security system needs a new source of cash. Baby boomers are about to retire, and there aren't enough younger workers paying in to support them all. So, commentator Robert Reich offered a solution on our show yesterday.
One logical way to deal with the crisis of funding Social Security and Medicare is to have more workers per retiree. And the simplest way to do that is to allow more immigrants into the United States.
Reich says the government should encourage immigration because a flush of younger foreign-born workers would make up for the gap we have now. This fix didn't seem like much of a fix at all to many of you. Listener Jonathan Jory of Winchester, Massachusetts, sums up a bunch of letters and comments we got on our website.
This is just a slow-acting Ponzi scheme to help maintain retiree benefits in the short term.
Jory and other listeners complain it wouldn't solve the problem once all those immigrants themselves reach retirement age. So we decided to consult someone who studies these things for a living. Dowell Myers is a professor of demography at the University of Southern California. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So is the former labor secretary proposing what amounts to a Ponzi scheme or no?
Well, a Ponzi scheme is a scam where there's really no actual investment and the money is just taken away. But every society invests in a younger generation so they can be better prepared to support the older generation. And that's not a Ponzi scheme, but it does base one generation's well-being on another one's.
Is this a solution for Social Security, do you think?
Well, the problem is we have so many baby boomers, and they are all going to deserve their entitlements, and we don't have relatively as many younger people. Immigrants do help. My calculations show that immigrants, though, only contribute about 1/4 of the solution. They can't solve the problem all by themselves.
Well, we've heard this idea from Professor Reich. Are there any other kinds of possible demographic solutions to fixing the system?
Well, the easiest one would be to delay retirement, because people live so much longer now than when we started the system. It used to be they would live only, on average, 1 year after they got entitlements, and now people are pushing it out to 20 and 30 years. And given that long lifespan after 65, more of that should be made productive, or else we can't balance our economy.
So what do you say about these immigrants? They are going to be getting entitlements themselves, so how do you respond to that?
Well, immigrants get older also, but not right away. Our big problem is the next 20 years. We have a steep cliff we have to climb. It was so many older folks all of a sudden, because of the baby boom, crossing age 65. We need some help just in the next 20 years. And after we get past 2030, we'll be in much better shape. But I don't know how we get there without some help.
And how urgent of a problem do you think this is?
Well, the first baby boomer crosses age 65 next year, and so here it comes.
Dal Myers is a professor of urban planning and demography at the University of Southern California here in Los Angeles. Thanks for giving us your analysis.
Okay, thank you.
You might have a different view, and it's always welcome at marketplace.org. A new and specialized kind of employment agency has just opened its doors in Britain. Force Select has been set up to find work for military veterans, and the agency can expect a steady stream of clients. More than 20,000 men and women leave the UK's armed forces every year, and they quickly learn that active service in Iraq or Afghanistan is one thing, but it can really get tough once they're out. As Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, they don't always get a hero's welcome in the jobs market back home.
At a barracks near London, a final parade for soldiers who have served their time. They may be hoping to march off smartly into civilian jobs. They may be disappointed. Mehmed Kavaz, a former sergeant in the British Army, speaks from bitter experience.
I've lost count of the amount of jobs I've applied for. We're struggling. I'm not the only one. Lots of friends of mine are in this position, and we just can't find work. We're struggling.
Mehmed returned from service in Afghanistan 6 months ago. He was a quartermaster, distributing food, fuel and other supplies. He thought there might be some demand for his skills in civilian life, but with no work on the horizon, he's getting anxious.
I'm rapidly approaching 40. The civilian job market can be quite ruthless. If I don't start working soon, people might start thinking he's a bit too old to come into our organisation.
A job in the army is more than your average job.
Unemployed veterans feel especially aggrieved. The recruitment ads led them to believe their service would make them fit for anything.
And give you the kind of qualifications and know-how they'll be looking for back in civilian life.
Hugh Andry is a former infantry officer. He's just set up the new employment agency for veterans. He reckons there could be 50,000 in Britain looking for jobs. Andry blames employers who are ignorant of military matters and personnel.
There's a real lack of understanding of the skills and experience they have and how to retrain and redeploy those skills and that experience to benefit companies.
And he says there's another factor militating against a smooth transition to civilian life.
Rifle, exercises, by numbers. Recover arms! One!
The routine and regimentation and the sense of security inside the forces. It can make it harder for some veterans to cope with the freewheeling vagaries of the outside world. Anthony Harrison served as a lieutenant in both the British and Australian armies.
In the military, no matter what happens, you get your pay. And no matter what happens, you've got housing. No matter what happens, the mess is there, there's going to be a meal.
Not in civilian life. Since he left the forces 13 years ago, Harrison has struggled. He launched a business that went bust. His marriage failed. He lost his home and wound up living rough on the streets of London. His military experience made that emotionally even more difficult to bear.
The low point was the realisation I had nowhere to go. When you have nowhere to go, it's not like if you're in the army on operation. a soldier support network. He's got his buddy in a trench over there. But when you're on the street and there's no support network, not having anywhere to go, that for me was my worst moment.
But some people involved in veteran welfare say the problems have been exaggerated. Harrison is now living in a hostel run by a charity called Veterans Aid. The chief executive is Hugh Milroy.
The reality is the vast bulk of veterans make the transition from the military into civilian life perfectly well.
W2's Bailey,
sir.
Gray,
sir.
Holder, Hearn.
Milroy says only a tiny number of vets wind up on the streets and 96% find work within 6 months of leaving the forces. But the unemployed vets say those figures are misleading. They include people who, out of desperation, have taken temporary menial work, like potato picking. 6 months after he left the army, Mehmet Kavaz is still jobless and disenchanted.
I do feel betrayed. I do feel let down. But it's nothing more than what I expected. It's a strong culture in this country that soldiers are not wanted.
The Ministry of Defence says all service leavers are offered resettlement and careers advice and some free retraining. The ministry said the veterans are the best of British. They have the skills and the attitude to succeed in any civilian job. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering GoToMyPC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. By Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm offering practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at nixonpeabody.com. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, why in the world would you possibly think the credit report this guy is pitching would be free?
F-R-E-E, that spells free, creditreport.com, baby.
There's a new law that websites offering free credit reports must now put a banner across the top of the page directing consumers to the only authorized source for those federally mandated reports, which is annualcreditreport.com. So it seems Experian, the credit reporting company that runs freecreditreport.com, has devised a way to avoid the banner. It's now charging $1 for its report and giving it to charity. The other catch is they require you to sign up for their $14.95 a month plan. The company insists there is no express or implied offer on its site for a free report at freecreditreport.com. Let me spell it out for you.
F-R-E-E, that spells free.
That's what I thought he said. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 29 points, about 0.25%. The Nasdaq rose 5 points, also 0.25%. The S&P 500 added 3 points, 0.33%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Hawes, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, Random Acts of Charity.
It's not about the $10. It's about the act of giving when there's no reason to give.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.